Canto, chapter 14, text 17, and we'll probably go till text 21. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Jnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Pancha Kalpaturupyascha Kripa Sindhu Vihivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Text 17 Gira Vacha Napite Namayam Swasti Prakriti Nam Tatatmanaha Yata prakriti bir gupta Puman raja cha saptabhi Ngira vaja Napite namayam svasti Prakriti nam tatatmana Ta prakriti bhirgupta Puman raja cha saptibi Angiro vacha Napite namayam svasti Prakriti nam tatatmana Yata prakriti bhiyukta Puman raja chasvaja Apite namayam svasti Prakriti nam tatatmana Yata prakriti bhiyukta Puman raja cha saptibhi Nangira vaja Napite namayam svasti Prakriti nam tadatmana Yata prakriti bhikupta Puman raja cha saptibhi Nangira vacha Napite namayam svasti Prakriti nam tatatmana Yata prakriti vaja cha saptibhi Nangira vacha The great sage Angira said, Api, whether, te, of you, anamayam, health, svasti, auspiciousness, prakritinam, of your royal elements, associates and paraphernalia, tata, as well as, atmanaha, of your own body, mind, and soul. Yata, like prakritibhi, by the elements of material nature. Guptaha, protected. Puman, the living being. Raja, the king. Cha, also. Saptibhi, by seven. Translation, the great sage Angira said, My dear king, I hope that your body and mind and your royal associates and paraphernalia are all well. When the seven properties of material nature, the total material energy, the ego, and the five objects of sense gratification are in proper order, the living entity within the material elements is happy. Without these seven elements, one cannot exist. Similarly, a king is always protected by seven elements, his instructor, Swami or Guru, his ministers, his kingdom, his fort, his treasury, his royal order, and his friends. Purport. As it is quoted by Sridhar Swami in his Bhagavatam commentary, Swamyamadyo chanapada durga dravina sanchayaha dando mitram tatasyaita saptaprak Kritayo mataha. A king is not alone. He first has his spiritual master, the supreme guide. Then come his ministers, his kingdom, his fortifications, his treasury, his system of law and order, and his friends or allies. If these seven are properly maintained, the king is happy. Similarly, as explained in Bhagavad Gita, Dehinosmin Yata Dehe, the living entity, the soul, is within the material covering of the Mahat Tattva, ego and Panchatanmatra, the five objects of sense gratification. When these seven are in proper order, the living entity is in a mood of pleasure. Generally, when the associates of the king are quiet and obedient, the king can be happy. Therefore, the great sage Angira Rishi inquired about the king's personal health and the good fortune of his seven associates. When we inquire from a friend whether everything is well, we are concerned not only with his personal self, but also with his family, his source of income, and his assistants or servants. All of them must be well, and then a person can be happy. I'll just read a bunch of verses because they're all kind of connected. Text 18, O King, O Lord of humanity, when a king directly depends upon his associates, and follows their instructions, he is happy. Similarly, when his associates offer their gifts and activities to the king and follow his orders, they are also happy. Purport, the actual happiness of a king and his dependents is described in this verse. A king should not simply give orders to his dependents because he is supreme. Sometimes he must follow their instructions. Similarly, the dependents should depend on the king. This mutual dependence will make everyone happy. Text 19. O king, are your wives, citizens, secretaries and servants, and the merchants who sell spices and oil under your control? Are you also in full control of ministers, the inhabitants of your palace, your provincial governors, your sons, and your other dependents? Purport, the master or king and his subordinates should be interdependent. Through cooperation, both of them can be happy. Text 20. If the king's mind is fully controlled, all his family members and governmental officers are subordinate to him. His provincial governors present taxes on time without resistance, and what to speak of lesser servants? Purport, Angirda Rishi asked the king whether his mind was also under control. This is most essential for happiness. And finally, text 21. O King Chitraketu, I can observe that your mind is not pleased. You seem not to have achieved your desired goal. Is this because of you yourself, or has it been caused by others? Your pale face reflects your deep anxiety. So, we're continuing our story of King Chitraketu. He was sad because he couldn't get a son. And then, just so happens that this great sage named Angira Muni happened to come upon the scene and started talking with Chitraketu. And Angira Muni, or Angira, the great sage, he knew how to deal with different people. So since Chitraketu, he was a king, he knew how to address the king properly. So he asked the king, how's it going? How's your kingdom? How are your associates? How's your fortress? How's your treasury? All these things. That's kind of how one would address a kshatriya. You would address them by asking them, how's the administration going? How's the management? How's the kingdom? Things like that. So if you were addressing a brahmana, you might ask, how is your study of the scriptures going? Learned any cool verses lately? You know, can you help give me some knowledge or something? You know, so you might address them like that. Or if there's a vaishya, you might ask how their business is doing. They like that. Or if you're addressing a shudra, you ask them, how are you? Because they work with their body, and you ask, how are they? Basically, you're asking how their body is. I know sometimes, like, Radhanath Maharaj, sometimes he doesn't like devotees asking him how his health is, because he says it's always bad, you know, so why, you know, I have to ask about how my health is doing. Okay, so anyway, in this Angira, when Angira is speaking to King Chitraketu, we kind of get a glimpse of what society should look like. We get a glimpse of what an ideal society is. And part of this ideal society is that there is a king, and that this king kind of takes counsel from others, especially from brahmanas. So this is one of the main elements needed for a well-functioning society, is that there is a competent king who takes counsel from brahmanas or his associates. It's not that he just says the way things are and he's the independent autocrat or something. And then, so this kind of was highlighted in one of the purports, is that there's this interdependent relationship between the king and his associates, or the citizens. The king, he gives instructions to his associates, and he also receives instructions from his associates. He gets advice from them. He understands how they're doing. And then the associates, they also, in turn, they offer their work, and their activities, and they give gifts to the king. So there's like this mutual dependence or interdependent relationship, mutual cooperation between the king and the citizens. This is kind of like how this, how a society should run. So there's this one class given by Mother Donna Kaley at Kitanagari in 2012 about this interdependent social structure and how it works. So I thought I'd just go a little bit more deeply into the different kinds of socioeconomic structures there are and kind of how it fits into this structure we're hearing about in the Bhagavatam right now under King Chitraketu's rule. So under King, there's socioeconomic structures under the mode of goodness, under the mode of passion, and under the mode of ignorance. And here we're kind of reading about a socioeconomic structure more or less under the mode of goodness. Seems like there's, and part of the socioeconomic structure is one of kind of interdependence, mutual dependence on each other. The economy in this social structure is, it's called like a subsistence economy. It's where the citizens, they basically follow the rule in the Isha Upanishad that one shouldn't take more than what is due to one's quota. You know, you just, individuals within the society, they take just what they need in order to subsist, and they don't take anything more than that. And then whatever's extra, that's just used it's like communal. Nobody owns anything, nobody owns any land or resources. You just take what you need to subsist, and everything kind of goes for the community and the well-being of the whole group, whole society. In this economy, in this subsistence economy, it's primarily an agrarian-based economy, so the main currency, if you will, is produce from the land, the grains, or the milk from the cows, or something land-based. And there's this system of gifting, where it's kind of giving and receiving. So you'll give a gift to somebody, but you don't give it in the kind of calculative mentality that I'm giving this gift to you, and I expect something equal or more in return. But rather, in this kind of economy, the citizens, they might give some gift or some service to somebody, but they don't expect reciprocation right away. They might just say, you know, whenever the reciprocation comes, that's great. But if not, this is just kind of my contribution to society. This is the way that citizens are thinking. I'm just contributing. I'm playing my part. I'm doing my role in society, and this is how I'm contributing, and that's kind of how that economy works. And then in this kind of economy, there are it breeds interdependent relationships with the citizens. Interdependent, like parts of the body to the body. You know, just like if one part of the body is kind of suffering, then the whole body suffers. Or if one part of the body is doing really well, the whole body benefits from that. So like Greg just busted his finger pretty good the other day. So he just that one little part of his body, it kind of got damaged, and that affected his whole body. He's in pain, and his consciousness is consumed in this. Not really, he actually did a good job kind of dealing with it, but like that, if you just, anybody gets like a little cut or whatever, the whole body suffers, not just that one little part. So there's this like interdependent relationship with the parts of the body and the whole body. And that's what it should be like in this larger socioeconomic structure between the citizens and everybody else. Everybody's interdependent. If one person rises in that structure, then everybody rises. If one person falls in that structure, everybody falls. You know, something like that. So you're dependent on each other. this can, there are certain aspects to any socioeconomic structure, and part of these aspects are, they include, you know, the dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Dharma, what is one's duty, artha, economic gain, kama, what one desires, and moksha, getting liberated from things, or talk of liberation. So in each of these kind of socioeconomic structures, there's different meanings to these words, dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So from this socioeconomic structure in the mode of goodness, we see that dharma is there, and the people are doing their duty out of a sense of duty. They do it as a contribution to society. They're not thinking only in them. It's motivated just out of a sense of duty. This is my contribution to society. And then artha is there. The economic development is there. Primarily, people are engaged in developing the economy, not for their own, you know, increase of wealth, but for the increase of wealth of the whole society. So they do strive for economic development, but not for themselves, but for everybody. And then there's kama there, and it's not kama just in the sense that I'm wanting to fulfill all my desires. People aren't pursuing it like that. They're just pursuing it just so that they can fulfill their needs, and not so much all of their wants. And then moksha, where, you know, this kind of lifestyle, it just naturally leads to thinking about the future. You know, that's part of one of these, you know, this socioeconomic structure and the mode of goodness, is that you are concerned with sustainability and long-term thinking and future generations. And naturally, this kind of thinking leads to you to thinking, okay, what's next? What happens after death? You know, so it's a, I don't know, I guess it's a more like progressive kind of system. So this is kind of the socioeconomic structure and the mode of goodness. Then there are socioeconomic structures in the mode of passion. And when passion is introduced, it kind of, you know, when passion is there, that means lust comes. And we know what happens. And when lust is there, we read from the Bhagavad Gita that it's the greatest enemy, and it's destroyer of the worlds and so many things. So now, if in this socioeconomic structure in the mode of passion, the economy is more, it's considered like a competitive economy. So now in this competitive economy, the playing field is level, but there's not an equal vision for having everybody, or taking care of everybody's needs. So the playing field is equal, but there's not this thinking of the larger community. So it leads to individuals who have perhaps more knowledge, who are more intelligent, who are stronger, who are more talented, those things. And so that then therefore it leads to some people having more and some people having less. And then in this kind of economy, money is introduced. Now, instead of there being an agrarian-based economy, now it's based on money. So if I do something for you, give you something or do some service for you, then I'm going to expect some monetary remuneration, some dollars. And if I give you something, I expect a certain amount of money that is equal in value to that thing that we both, that it's worth. And I expect an equal exchange, at least, in this kind of economy. And in this kind of economy, it leads to relationships that are independent. So in the mode of goodness, these kind of, it breeds interdependent relationships where one is dependent on each other. In the mode of passion, socioeconomic structure, it breeds independent, you know, mentality. People become independent because now it kind of leads to each man for himself kind of mentality. So now I make money for me and my family. You make money for you and your family. And And at the end of the day, we really don't have much to do with each other. You know, I kind of take care of myself, you take care of yourself. It leads to kind of like a, more of like a survival of the fittest kind of mentality, or, you know, a sort of struggle for existence. Or, you know, so there's some that have more, some that have not. And then this also leads to people having like individual bank accounts, individual, people own their own properties. There's this, so like somebody who is really good in this structure, who can make a lot of money, like they'll have a nice house down the street or something, and with all the nice things. And then somebody who in this structure doesn't know how to make a lot of money or whatever, they'll have some little shack and they have to pay rent for it or something, you know, like it's like a disparity is introduced. So this is kind of the kind of relationships that are breeded in this kind of socioeconomic structure in the mode of passion. So dharma, artha, kama, moksha are still there. So in the way dharma works in this kind of structure is that people are motivated by, what can I get out of this? You know, it's not out of a sense of duty, it's out of a sense of, you know, how much dollars can I, how can I do this in such a way that I'm gonna earn money? That they do things with as a means to get money. That's kind of like the motivation behind doing their duty. And then in artha, there's, you know, the economic structure is money. It's not based on the cows and grains and things like that. And then kama, instead of just getting what you need, now it's doing things so that you can get what you want. And so now there's some people who have more things and some people who have less things. And how that works. And then moksha is there, but it might only be there in the sense that people want to be saved from their sins. Like, because in the socioeconomic structure, inevitably you have to step on people's toes to get what you want, to get more of what you want. And you might have done things in such a way that might not have been the most morally acceptable thing to do, and you might be worried about your own self and your salvation, so you'll think of moksha in terms of, please save me from my sins. And this is kind of how that works. So then there's socioeconomic structure in the mode of ignorance. And this socioeconomic structure is kind of based on exploitation. So here the playing field that everybody is in, it's no longer level. It's tilted to favor one group of people and to disfavor another group of people. They call this predatory or vulture economics, where it's the system is designed. It's designed ahead of time so that certain people will not be able to get what they need. And therefore, it's already predetermined that some people are going to perish in this system. So it's no longer even survival of the fittest. It is, let's kill the weak. That's this socioeconomic structure in the mode of ignorance. And when it comes to relationships in this kind of socioeconomic structure, there's relationships, it breeds a kind of dependent relationships in the mode of, in the socioeconomic structure, in the mode of goodness, it bred interdependent relationships. In the mode of passion, it bred independent kind of relationships. And then in the mode of ignorance, it breeds dependent relationships. So with the, you know, so this could mean like, have you heard of the term wage slaves, where people become wage slaves, where they just they do something. They do a job or something. It might not be beneficial to society. In fact, it might lead to the demise of society. And people do things in which that they might morally they don't feel really good about doing. But the situation is such that either they have to do it in order to survive, or if they say, no, I don't want to do this, this is too much, or whatever, Then, okay, good, you're out. We have 10 other people lined up ready to take your job or whatever. So this is socioeconomic structure in the mode of ignorance. And here in this structure, there are no dharmas out the window. There's no such thing as dharma in this particular structure. Going to work from 9 to 5 is not dharma. It is, dharma is, you know, what's your contribution to society? But in this system, you're not contributing to society. You're actually doing things which are harmful for society. And then moksha, there's no question of moksha either, because you can even survive here. How are you thinking about beyond the future? It's not possible. And then the only thing is there is artha and kama. And then artha, it's, you know, wealth. It's all stolen money. It's all gotten by cheating and dishonest means. And then kama is there. It's even beyond more so what I want. Now the mentality is, how much can I get? It's like just like this real raw greed that's there. And then, you know, you hear that famous quote from Gandhi saying that the world has enough for every man's needs, but not enough for even one man's greed. So kind of this becomes the driving force behind this economic structure. So we can look at these three different kinds of socioeconomic structures, and then we can take a look at our world today. You know, we can even take a vote. We got one vote, so you believe that our society today is in the mode of goodness? How many people believe our society today, socioeconomic structure, is in the mode of goodness? Anybody? What? Only Michael. Okay, so how many believe our socioeconomic structure is in the mode of passion? 3, 4, okay, about half. And then how many believe that our socioeconomic structure is in the mode of ignorance? A little bit more than half. Okay, so certainly a strong mix of passion and ignorance is there. Seems like it's universal, except maybe with the exception of Michael. It's universal that we just have our little structure, or a little analysis of these structures, and it's clear that we're mostly influenced by the mode of passion and ignorance in our society. So then we can look at, what does Prabhupada want? Like what is the Vedic idea of what an ideal society looks like? Here we're learning about, we're having a nice example of King Chitraketu's rule and how it was at that time. But we can look at what are some principles behind what is an ideal social economic structure. And similar to what we're reading about here in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 3, we read about this interdependent relationship or mutual cooperative relationship that the men have with the demigods. So just like here, we're learning how the citizens have a kind of a interdependent relationship with the king, and then there's mutual cooperation between the king and the citizens. You know, the citizens do things for the king, and the king does things for the citizens, and it's mutual cooperation. So similarly, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's described that when the living entities, they perform their prescribed duties, and they do sacrifice, and they please the demigods, then the demigods are pleased, and then prosperity reigns for all. So there's this mutual cooperation between men and demigods, similar to cooperation between a king and his citizens. And we also hear about that there is this like division of society according to the four varnas. You know, everybody has a propensity to work. But there's one thing that's common for everybody, is that everybody is service. Everybody is meant to and wants to serve the whole social structure. So it's kind of our duty to arrange things in such a way that everybody can contribute to society. So it's interesting to think when you. We all agreed that we're living in a society which is mostly, I don't know, I guess, influenced by the mode of passion and ignorance. And we see sometimes that devotees are in situations where they might be living in or working in such a society. You know, they grew up in it, or they're so entrenched in it that they can't like, it's very difficult for them to not be a part of it. You know, so a lot of times devotees are swept into some job that they don't really want to do, but they do it because of, could be a number of reasons. So sometimes devotees, they might justify their involvement with doing some job that might not be so, I don't know, in the mode of goodness or something. They might say, well, I'm just trying to make the best use of a bad bargain. Like, you know, they say that if life hands you lemons, make lemonade. So I'm just making the best use of that. Here's my situation, and, you know, I'll still try to practice Krishna consciousness, but here I am having this job. So sometimes devotees, can misunderstand what Prabhupada says when he says make the best use of a bad bargain. Prabhupada doesn't mean when he says make the best use of a bad bargain to keep your situation such that you're always getting a bad bargain. But rather you should use your intelligence, your capabilities, your talents, your organizational skills, your whatever, to try to help create a situation in which devotees can live and work interdependently, you know, according to, like, to strive for some kind of more mode of goodness or even transcendental kind of social economic structure. And this is what Prabhupada wanted. One, because, you know, so he wanted us to try to develop this interdependent social structure so that we don't have to go out and be a part of what we all agreed was this, you know, social economic structure out there, which is influenced by the mode of passion and ignorance. So we don't have to be a part of that. And two, because we're following the you know, we're trying to carry out the will of our previous acharyas, that this is what they wanted. This is like the most progressive environment for people to be able to take up Krishna consciousness. Because the devotees can contribute to the whole world spiritually as well as materially if they just do their duties. And, you know, you can help each other serve Krishna better because you're going to make, you know, there's produce there and it can just be offered right to Krishna. And then third, this another reason why this is important is because it can reach a larger audience to help, it can bring a larger group of people to Krishna consciousness. Because right now, we're not grabbing a very large percentage of the population with our current, you know, perhaps temples and cities and, you know, kind of integrating our preaching with the way the current society is. Not everybody is a brahmana and totally or transcendental to their situation, and they're not able to just be brahmanas in temples in the city. That's not everybody's nature. Most people are in the other varnas, and we don't have always so much engagement for them. So if we have this kind of interdependent social economic structure in place, then we can kind of, our net will be wider. We'll be able to get more people into the orbit of Krishna consciousness. So here we're reading about the kind of relationships that King Chitraketu had with his citizens. It was this loving relationship of interdependent, it was loving interdependent relationship that the king had with the citizens. So we can ask ourselves, is it such relationship that doesn't have interdependency as its root or as its foundation? Like how possible is it to really develop genuine, loving, interdependent relationships among devotees or among people, if our society isn't structured in such a way that that is its foundation? For example, we can go to festivals, or we can go to retreats, we can go to festivals, we can come and do service together, and so many things. But at the end of the day, we don't really need each other. I mean, So sometimes there's a confusion between teamwork and interdependency. So teamwork means, okay, you wash the pots, you cook the rajbhog, you do the RT, you do the administration, and then like that we'll cover everything and we'll work together to get everything done. That's teamwork. Interdependency, on the other hand, is that there's this common economic interest where everybody's literally interdependent. They need the other person to survive. It's like both economically and everything, like in every aspect of life. I need you, you need me. Everybody each contributes to the society. Everybody is unique and individual and has their own unique individual contribution, which only they can contribute. So there's no such thing as like, being fired from your position or anything because everybody's contributing something to the society. The reason why interdependent relationships are so important in spiritual life is because it helps us not to fall into Maya. If we're so interdependent on somebody else and they start to stray a little bit, either materially or spiritually, it's going to be in everybody's interest to help that person to come back on the path and correct that. And so it kind of makes everybody have a sense of responsibility for each other, and that's how things can be progressive in like this social structure. So I think I'll stop there. Most of this just came from that class from. Donna Kayla gave from Kina Nagri, so I'd recommend listening to it again if you want more details. It's really nice. So, any comments or questions? We'll go with Terrence first, and then Krishnanam.
Hi, Krishna. Thank you for a lovely class. I couldn't help but think when I was hearing your class, it made me want to cross-reference to when I was reading the Tao a few years ago, something that you were speaking on interdependence, and you brought up this idea of more of a spiritual communism, like Prabhupada speaks about more or less a high standard of thinking with simple living. So this sort of the sage does not accumulate for himself. The more that he expends for others, the more does he possess of his own. The more that he gives to others, the more does he have himself. And you were bringing up the idea how Prabhupada always stressed, more of a community living situation. And I also appreciate the fact that you were speaking in reference to how so many services bring up to that standard where they can rise to a level of appreciating, being in a community setting. I was often thinking how maybe sometimes we have this interdependent mentality because we base our situations off of it's more ego driven. Like maybe our personalities may not mesh well within a community standing, so we feel sort of isolated at times, which puts us in our
You
own
mean
bubble.
independent,
And yeah,
not
exactly. More
interdependent.
independent than
Independent.
interdependent. We have this mentality that, well, how can I serve in this community if I don't fit in? And that may lead to, excuse me, it may lead to a certain amount of doubts as, how valuable am I to this community? Is it important for me to be here? Or can I even offer any service to Prabhupada or his devotees? These were some of the I guess I'm not asking a question. These were more or less comments that I had that maybe other Prabhus, if they feel so inclined to do so, can maybe add on and share what their other thoughts. And oh, it was another point that I found where it says the great state only wishes to unite man together and nourish them. A small state only wishes to be received by and to serve the other. Each gets what it desires, but the great state must learn to abase itself. So I guess in the spirit of interdependence, the more we can more or less rely on each other as a collective, it brings a sense of unity where there's not just these separate parts, as you would say, limbs of a tree or the body, and, you know, a sudra or a vaisha or someone who's more of a Brahminical culture or that may be their nature, they can work together and find ways to facilitate each other with their services. And it's not so much, this Prabhu is right here, he's so high and he's so intelligent, and this Prabhu right here, he can only, you know, bust some scrubs in the kitchen or scrub some floors. So that was just the thought that I had. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Or Krishna Nam?
Hare Krishna Baba. I was thinking in Vedic times, the king without this Kshatriya king, the society cannot function, right?
It's like, well, there are different kind of governments. You can do a little analysis of the kind of governments that there are in the world today. And well, there are some governments that are, you know, kind of attempting to be run by the brahmanas of society.
Correct.
And like, there's some groups, some countries or some parts of the world where the brahmanas are running things. There's some parts where the kshatriyas are running things. There's some parts where the vaishyas are running things, and some parts where the shudras are running things. And there are issues with each of these parts. It doesn't work. I mean, the best Vedic system, the best system, is there's a qualified Kshatriya who has a counselor who is under the guidance of qualified Brahmana.
Yeah. Anyway, my point was that the Kshatriya is very important. The king is very important in a society. But nowadays, there are no Kshatriya kings. And I was just thinking, let's imagine that if ISKCON has these communities, like farm communities, where we can establish something, like Varnashrama. Oh, and I was thinking about the Hungary's farm, and there your spiritual master, His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj. Oh, he's not your spiritual master. Anyway, His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj, he's like the leader there. So I was just thinking, because nowadays it's Kali Yuga, and you know we're all quarrel and everything. So if there is not a leader in a farm community, Can we establish like an environment in the mode of goodness, like you said?
Can we do this? Like,
yeah.
You're saying, is it possible to actually have a society in which?
Yeah. Do you think this is possible? Right. Yeah. And without a leader, yeah, because otherwise everyone would want to happen what he wants, and you know there will be quarrels and everything.
Yeah, that's typical. That's why we have to use our intelligence, and we really have to work together to figure out what works to be able to create this socioeconomic situation. This is clearly what Prabhupada wanted, and we tried so many things over the past so many decades to try and make it work. Some places it's working better than other places, and it seems like we're still trying to figure it out. In Hungary, they did have this. Shivaram Maharaj clearly was the leader there, and everybody looked up to him. He was a source of inspiration and very good at organization and things. So, plus, they just have a really strong community of devotees in Hungary. So, with all of these things put together, they were able to have something work there. You know, plus the laws are different too. So it's like they have a whole different structure there, which makes it like a completely different animal to deal with than here in Chicago or in the United States, where there's different laws and different types, different kinds of people, and we haven't really seen something where this is like we can. There's some projects where we might have had some success, but there are a lot of projects where we may have had a lot of failures. So as a kind of as a society, we're all going to have to work together to try to figure out somehow how to make this work, which we've been trying to do for a while, and it's not so easy. So it's going to take cooperation, mutual cooperation, commitment and dedication among that. From the individual's perspective, that's what it's going to take, is commitment, dedication to this kind of lifestyle making this happen, and cooperation with other devotees. That's from our side, that's how it's going to happen. Like, that's how we can try to develop to make it happen. And then just trying to support efforts in that way. So if you, there are devotees who are trying to do something, you know, there's, you can support it in so many different ways. So that's about all I can say about that now. Luke, do you have something on this point?
I'm grateful Krishna Nanpuru raised these two doubts, because they're common doubts that I've heard whenever this topic is brought up of Varnashram Dharma. Being one who would be king or who would be the leader, and two, it's Kali Yuga, so basically we're all condemned to quarrel and hypocrisy. But my conviction is that these aren't real obstacles, and there seems to be sufficient shastric evidence also. Maybe you could share, you know, your thoughts, but to the first point, finding a qualified king, qualified leader, we hear that a devotee, one who becomes a qualified Vaishnava, is transcendental to the Varnashram system, and he's capable of performing the duties of any one of the four Varnas. He is, his body is the residence of all the demigods. He's endowed with all good qualities. So certainly, if one in the community of devotees becomes a qualified Vaishnava, he would be competent to serve as a qualified Kshatriya, which isn't even like as high of a qualification on the pay scale or whatever. And to the second point, Kali Yuga, devotion, wherever there is devotional service, then the influence of Kali cannot enter. And like Maharaj Pariksit, just by establishing his reign and bringing, you know, having these four pillars of religion strong, then Kali was like, well, where am I going to live? You know, there's no gambling, there's no meat eating, there's no illicit sex. Where am I going to stay? So what to speak of a community where devotional service is being practiced by the majority of its members? Then definitely Kali will have no room to enter there. So this is my kind of whenever I hear these doubts, which I think, I mean, it's the nature of doubt that they're kind of persistent and they circulate within a community, but it seems that there's substantial evidence to kind of refute these concerns. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, I mean, what you're saying is true, yeah, that Vaishnavas are kind of above the Varnas, can perform the function of any other, and of any of the Varnas in service to Krishna. That's true. That, you know, if there's really strong devotional service, Kali can't come and influence that particular environment. So yeah, I mean, ultimately that's everybody's responsibility, is to make their sadhana strong, their devotional service strong. And then you won't be affected so much by what goes on in Kali Yuga, perhaps. But most of the people are, majority of the people on in the country now are, you know, they would need some kind of engagement in their varna to be able to peacefully practice Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, they're not gonna take to Krishna consciousness, and might not get that opportunity. So it's our duty, I guess, to be able to develop such a structure, and it's not always so easy. But yeah, these are good principles to consider when you're making plans and stuff. Thanks. Manju.
Thank you for that thought-provoking class. My question is somewhat, is just a clarification on what Krishnanampuru was saying. I feel like his question wasn't fully answered. I don't have a doubt that this can be performed. Obviously, it's Krishna's world, so if the devotee desires, anything is possible. But his question specifically was, can such a community be possible without strong leadership in place? And the answer, what you gave from what I understood, was that we as devotees have a responsibility to make a commitment to something like this. And I feel like that still doesn't answer his question, really, because at the heart of that question is...
Yeah, because people are committed to persons. Like, I'm not going to commit to like an institution or something impersonal. You commit to people, to persons who you're inspired by. So that's kind of another reason why Hungary was so, you know, the farm community in Hungary was so, you know, successful, is because everybody was so committed to Shivaram Maharaj. Shivaram Maharaj was pushing this like anything. Nobody wanted to be involved in the farm community on their own there. It was only because of Shivaram Maharaj's kind of, force, more or less, you know, that devotees moved into the farm community. All right, you 40 devotees, go start, you know, move into the farm community. They would not do that on their own. But because they have such, they're so inspired by Shivaram Maharaj, they're able to commit to him for so many lifetimes. And this is what he wanted? Great, I'll do it. So, you know, we might need something like that. You know, even like in Hungary, that's what they say in Hungary, is that this, if you're going to try to develop some farm community, it needs to be supported on the highest levels of leadership. In your society. So in our case, it'd be like the GBC has to have full support, the local leaderships, any influential leader in our society of devotees, they have to back this project for it to even have a chance of working. This is the advice that was given to us by Radha Krishna Prabhu, a leader in Hungary. So yeah, that needs to be there, that commitment to a person and strong leadership, of course. Otherwise, how are we going to have something? I think this will be our last comment with Jitendra, and then we'll end.
Thank you. I was just thinking of the 12th canto. It describes the people of Kali Yuga. You know, they're short-lived, misguided, and most of all disturbed. So, and then Prabhupada, when he came, he said, Krishna has sent me no first-class men, only fourth and fifth, and, you know, down the road. So... He's dealing with a real difficult group of people. So and then I remember Mahatma Gandhi saying that there's enough for every man's greed, every man's need, but not every man's greed. So today's economy is built on, I think Prabhupada said it's built on envy, because there's no unity. So people are, you know, just, you know, going for themselves, you know, like a kind of a smash and grab economy, you know, get what they can get, and then smash and grab. That's what this friend of mine, he comes here and gets the oil. He lives in the west side of Chicago, and it's really bad. And I asked him, about what did he concisely think about the neighborhood there, and he says, well, it's a drug economy, smash and grab. And that kind of says a lot right there. But you know what's going on in today's economy is a lot, but it's more subtle, you know. But there's an identity crisis in Kali Yuga, so there's no real cooperation because people don't know really who they are. So how can they really cooperate with one another? And then I remember Srila Prabhupada was in one big city, and he was standing on a balcony. I think it was New York or something. He was with one of his sannyasis, and the sannyasi said, because all the people are going to work, I think it was New York, you know, and he says, Prabhupada, it's just, sometimes I feel compassion for them, you know. And Prabhupada said, sometimes you should feel compassion for them all the time, you know. But he said, they will not come. They will not come. They're too set in their ways. Then another one is, this is a purport. Down the road, I just read a few purports ahead of you. But I remember Bhakti Siddhanta said that the face is the index of the mind. So that says a lot right there. And then there's a television program. I don't watch television, but it's, you know, we have Suburbia. But the name of the program is Disturbia. So So this is the things that are so prevalent. But and then Prabhupada says our only interest is to make people happy, you know, but they don't know what true happiness is. And then I was just thinking, you know, did you ever see the stock market pit where people are just so gung-ho on, you know, it's just like total madness. There's one devotee that comes here, Kali Chandra, and he was telling me about it. He says the frenzy is so intense that you can't believe it, you know. But this is what's going on. So so without, you know, Krishna consciousness, there can be no real true brotherhood. So they talk about brotherhood, but there's, you know, there's just, it's really not there. It's just kind of, it looks good on paper, but it's really not there at all. Did you want to say anything, Mariah?
Okay. Thanks. Okay, with that, one, thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai. Oh, yeah, we have a brahmachari meeting.
Hold on, before everyone leaves, hold on. Instead of going downstairs, we're going to be past the people. By the time we go downstairs,
we have a brahmachari meeting here in the temple.
Just here in the corner, we'll just do our meeting quickly. Because by the time we go downstairs, people wander off, and we're looking for everyone. It's just such a huge waste of time. Let's just do it here real quick, you know, in front of the DVDs. It's okay, since the DVDs can also be able to talk. That's my suggestion. I think that's better, you know, instead of, because half the people are going to disappear by the time we go downstairs. Let's just do it here.